It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's Chef Jasper White of Boston's Summer Shack Restaurants. He teaches us how to cook like you're on vacation, as in fast, easy, and you do all the work in the cool of the day. Jasper's got the tricks. His book is The Summer Shack Cookbook. You can't stand red wine, especially in the heat. Open your mind. That master of the grape, Joshua Wesson, has some reds that will lure you away from that Chardonnay. We have the saga of Italy's true San Marzano tomato rising from its own ashes from Nancy Harmon Jenkins. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. Michael, I drive out to Denver a lot, and I drive through Nebraska. Have you had any finds there?
Absolutely. Nebraska actually has one regional specialty that you'll find nowhere else. It goes by several names. One is it's called a runza. That name has been actually trademarked. It's also called a burek. And this is a pastry that fully encloses ground meat, cabbage, and spice. Huh. It's kind of like a pasty that you'd find in the upper parts of Michigan. Mm-hmm. And this is something that was brought by a group called the Volga Germans. When they came to this country, they were Germans who went to Russia, then got kicked out of Russia, and came to the U.S. and became farmers. And they brought with them the burek, which is a great portable meal. It's real comfort food, like old world comfort food. And we have found it nowhere other than in Nebraska.
You know, let me just stop and minute to sing the praises of Nebraska. I fell in love with that state. I mean, talk about the last great undiscovered part of America. Gearing, Nebraska, looks like a town from the last picture show. I mean, it's like pure 1930s Main Street. And the Gearing Bakery is a little old-fashioned bakery with homemade cookies and donuts and wonderful cream pies and whipped cream cakes. But the town itself is just the essence of that part of Nebraska, which is the Great Plains, the simplicity, the almost sort of poetic emptiness that you don't find in America very often anymore. I just fell in love with that state.
I think you're right. It is one of the most beautiful places, and that incredible prairie. But is the bakery where you get, it's called Runza? Is that what the meat pie is called?
It used to be called Runza. However, the name Runza was actually trademarked by a corporation. And now in and around Lincoln, Nebraska, there are Runza restaurants that look almost like McDonald's or Burger King. They're plasticine. Yeah. You can't call this thing a runza anymore lest you infringe on their trademark. So it's called a burek. Or at the Gearing Bakery, we were driving past along the main street in Gearing, and I was admiring this beautiful sign on the Gearing Bakery, a real old, wonderful, you know, small-town sign. Mm-hmm. Jane looked past the sign to a little note in the window that said Cabbage Burgers. And suddenly that like kind of rang a bell with us. Like, that's probably a burek or a runza by another name. We went in, and sure enough, that's exactly what it was. They have a couple of tables in the bakery. We ordered a couple of these cabbage burgers and sat down and ate this classic Nebraska snack.
It sounds fabulous. Where is Gearing?
Gearing is in the far western part of the state, what they call the Panhandle. And I'll tell you, we were driving through Gearing only because we were on our way to one of the great roadside attractions in Alliance, Nebraska, which is not that far away, a place called Carhenge. Have you ever been there, Lynn?
No, I haven't.
Carhenge is an exact replica of Stonehenge, except made with old American automobiles instead of stones.
With their fins up in the air.
It's
and
an
their
amazing sight.
Heads down in the ground.
We got to make a trip. There's no question.
Yeah, it's definitely, it's road trip central.
This
and
is great.
After your cabbage burger, you do have to, at the Gearing Bakery, have this wonderful nutty thing we found there, which is a big soft pretzel frosted with peanut butter icing. And it was really quite wonderful.
That sounds pretty great, too. Hey, guys, thank you. Nebraska vacation. I like this. Take
Here
care.
Here we come. Bye.
I Lynn. You were talking about the Michael Stern's latest tome is Road Food Sandwiches. Now, the Sterns check in here with us every week, but you can get their food finds anytime you want. You just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Well, the time has come for my annual soapboxing about melon salads. Melons are nearly as versatile as tomatoes, and they are great with fresh cheese, any kind of vinaigrette or creamy dressing, with greens, even with pieces of salami and onion. Now, the salad I keep going back to is a Thai cantaloupe salad. You season chunks of sweet cantaloupe with lime, chilies, onion, Thai basil, and just a little Asian fish sauce. You put that next to just about anything, and you are going to be a very happy camper. Now, if you puree that salad, you've got a great cold soup. And then there's my friend Judy's take. She purees everything, pours it over ice, and adds the vodka. Life is good. What I love about wine expert Joshua Wesson is that he's a cheap date. Now, here's a guy who's been sommelier in some of the priciest restaurants in New York City. And what does he turn into a business? Hunting down great wines at modest prices. He's got bestsellers wine shops. And Josh is our go-to guy for all of our wine puzzles. Josh, welcome back.
Always good to be with you.
Josh, what do you serve people who say they only drink white wine? And you'd really like to serve a red.
And there are so many people who say that. Of course, on the other side, there are people who believe that a wine's first job is to be red. But
I
will tell you, there red wines for folks who hate reds can be a bit of a challenge. Because what is it about red wine that people find off-putting? Well, sometimes it can be a tendency to have an allergic reaction to something in the red wine.
Mm-hmm.
But most people aren't allergic to red wines. They're when they say they don't like red, there are a couple of things that they're implying, even if they're not articulating it. And the big one is that red wines tend to have more tannin than white wines. The stuff that makes you pucker comes from skins of grapes and, to a lesser extent, stems in the barrels that wines might be made in. But it's a tactile reaction that can be off-putting to a lot of wine drinkers. I just know people who don't like to pucker up unless they're kissing somebody. And there's also a relative austerity to red wines. They generally don't have sweetness, and they don't have as much obvious fruit as white wine in most cases. So that can be a little bit off-putting to people who are used to drinking wines that are either a touch sweet or very fruity. And then, of course, there's the whole issue of refreshment. You know, you're taught to serve red wines at room temperature or pretty close to room temperature, and white wines are served much cooler. They offer that instant refreshment, and everybody likes things that are cold. We're brought up drinking things that are cold, so there's a tendency to sort of seek those things out. But I think if you understand that those are issues that can be dealt with, you can have very happy tastings with folks who might not be aware that red wines can be chilled, or red wines that are fruity can be enjoyed just like a white wine, or red wines that don't have a lot of tannin. Won't make your mouth pucker up. You don't have to live in fear. You don't have to live in a segregated world anymore.
But what would you suggest then?
Forget a life of denial and fear. and embrace red wines that are fruity, perhaps even a little bit sweet, that are low in tannin and eminently chillable. And amazingly, that means wines that are inexpensive, because as soon as you give a winemaker some money to play with, they'll end up, especially if they're making a red wine, they'll make it pretty substantial, and they'll make it full-bodied, and they'll make it full of tannin, and they'll play with wood. You know, they like to take all the toys at their disposal and end up, you know, turning a wine into something substantial, which is exactly what you don't want to give to someone who doesn't like red wine.
So stay on the cheap side. This is getting better every moment. So can you name some names?
Yeah. Well, you know, when I say cheap, inexpensive, really, we won't say cheap on the show, you know, $10, $9, $8. And if you look for California Pinot Noir and Zinfandel that are $10, $11, $9, you won't be giving enough money to the winemaker to have them muck it up with oak or tannins or thyme in for bad behavior. Mm-hmm, and you end up producing wines that are just full of fruit, that are delicious, almost gulpable, that go right into the glasses of people who say they won't drink reds. One of my favorites right now is from Montpellier. It's a Pinot Noir. It's 2005, and it's all of $10. Sometimes you can find it for $8 or $9, and just chuck it in the fridge almost as if it was a white wine, and you'll make very happy people of folks who fear red.
Any other specific wines?
Sure. Rosenblum makes a non-vintage Zinfandel, which is available everywhere. It's all of $10. And that's another wine that can take a slight chill, not as much as the Pinot Noir that I mentioned,
right.
But it doesn't have any tannin to speak of. It's incredibly fruity. It's really melted black cherry jello for adults. It's incredible. And riffing on that, you know, you don't have to stay in California. If you were to go over to Australia and look for $10 Shiraz, it almost doesn't matter who's making it, as long as it's young, 2005, 2006, you're going to find a red wine that has a high odds probability of pleasing someone who says that they don't like reds. Wolf Blass is a very consistent producer, and you can find that wine for $9 or $10. Again, throw it in the fridge for a little bit, and you'll make the red wine fearful very happy.
Well, Josh, speaking of throwing it in the fridge, about how long should you chill these bottles?
About half an hour, but I wouldn't get too caught up or neurotic about timing. It could be 20 minutes. It could be 45 minutes.
Uh-huh.
You're not going to hurt the wine as long as you don't leave it in for hours and hours, because even light, fruity red wines can turn a little bit bitter when they're super cold.
Interesting.
Of course, there's a cure for that. You just take it out of the fridge if you've left it in too long and wait about 20 minutes, and it will be at the perfect temperature. The French call that chambering, or having the wine come up to room temperature. But I love red wines that are inexpensive and pretty much tannin-free with a little chill on them. Beaujolais was probably the first red wine to go cold. And that would be another good choice. You know, a simple Beaujolais,
yeah.
not a cru Beaujolais, not one from a specific place, right. But a straight Beaujolais. The cheapest Beaujolais, maybe a Beaujolais Village. And if you get a young one, you throw it in the fridge for 20 minutes or half an hour, spend $10 or $11, everyone at the table will be happy.
You know, we used to warm wine by hugging it, but that's a whole other issue. Hey, Josh, thank you.
I think that's going to require at least 6 sessions on the couch.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Joshua Wesson is author of the cult classic Red Wine with Fish, and he's co-creator of the bestsellers Wine Shops. Now, you can find Josh's red wines for people who hate red wine on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're at it, sign up for our e-newsletters. We've got Weeknight Kitchen. Now, this one's devoted to making worknight suppers easier, and our summer offering, The Griller's Chronicle. Now, we have only 1 month left, but find them both at splendidtable.org. Coming up, summer food from a master, Chef Jasper White, and the return of the lost San Marzano tomato. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Archer Farms Foods, from organic spinach and feta pizza to Parmesan and garlic potato chips. You can find Archer Farms flavor pairings for every palate at SuperTarget. It's been said Chef Jasper White has handled more seafood than any other chef in the country. Well, true or not, Jasper is a master of cooking fish. Now, he started out in Boston with a terribly elegant restaurant, and it was very good. But then he did this complete about-face and opened the Summer Shack. Now, this place is huge, casual, and it serves a style of food that you may not know unless you live on the coast. Well, Jasper's book is The Summer Shack Cookbook, A Complete Guide to Shore Food. Hey, Jasper, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I think you better define shore food for everybody who's in the middle of the country.
Well, you know, people say, why don't you say beach food? And the shore is way more than the beach. I mean, the beach is part of it, but there's the inlets, there's the rivers. Ugh. There are the highways, the bars, the farms. It's, you know, it's a region, and it's a region that pretty much up and down the East Coast is got a lot of seafood and a lot of farms. And in terms of cooking, you know, summer is the season that people at the shore have the most time and the best food to work with. And we don't fuss. We take the food, and I feel like our job is to not screw it up, because if you're down at Long Beach Island in New Jersey and you catch a striped bass and the bass is out of the water for 4 hours, I mean, all you can do is mess it up. You're not going to make it taste any better than it tastes.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Freehold, New Jersey, which is about 10 miles from Asbury Park from the shore. And I grew up, you know, fishing, crabbing, and eating all the local food, mostly for a couple of reasons. One, my family's Roman Catholic, so we always ate fish on Friday.
Right.
And two, because it was usually free. Either we caught it or somebody would give it to us. So we ate seafood more than once a week. And I have a great love for just the pure flavor of unadulterated seafood.
And that's what Summer Shack is. So it's really the food of you remember growing up with.
A lot of it. Summer Shack, because I've been in New England now for 30 years, a lot of it has more of a New England accent than it has that New Jersey accent. But it's really the same food. And what I found is from Shediac, New Brunswick in Canada to the Caribbean, there's a commonality in shore food, and it has to do with the style of cooking, the amount of work that it takes, which is not a lot, and the fact that you just take these great ingredients and get them out to the table as quickly as you can. I say in the book that, you know, don't think of your kitchen as a production facility or even worse, an art studio, but think of it as a transfer station. And food comes in, you do something to it quickly, and the food goes out, and that's the way it works.
You know, I want to talk about summer cooking strategies, because you have a section in the book where you say strategies for keeping cool in the kitchen.
Well, I think in the summer, you know, unless you have no life at all, the afternoon should be for going to the beach, playing tennis, golf, fishing, hiking, biking, whatever it is you do, not cooking. And because the food is so beautiful, you know, if you live near a farm stand and you have fresh sun-ripened tomatoes. I mean, really, how long does it take to slice a few tomatoes and put a little salt and olive oil on them? Because that's really all they need.
So do you have specific ideas of how we should set ourselves up for this kind of cooking?
Yes, I certainly do. I call it the morning kitchen. And years ago, I worked down in the Caribbean, and it was so hot in the afternoons in the kitchen that we basically shut it down completely. And we all went to work at 5 in the morning when it was still cool. And we did almost everything. We cooked breakfast, we got lunch ready, and we got almost everything ready for dinner. By noon, we are out of the kitchen. We take a 5-hour break, come back, and then serve dinner. And we would have dinner ready in 20 minutes. And so I kind of took that strategy and applied it to home cooking. For instance, you make a cold cucumber sauce in the morning, and you're out and about, and you go to the fish market. It doesn't matter if you have swordfish or striped bass. You know, the sauce will go with both of them. So pick out the fish that looks best and bring it home. And when you get home, you just fire up the grill, cook the swordfish, you know, slice the tomatoes, maybe boil up some corn on the cob, and, you know, you've got a great meal.
Yeah. One of the things that I always associate with New England is steamers, the clams that you get a big pot of them. They're cooked more or less in their own liquid, a little water.
There is a special pot that can be used. You don't have to, but it has a spigot on the bottom of it. And you put just enough water to get the steam going in the bottom of the pot. Then there's a rack that the steamers sit on. And I usually add a little celery. You could add a little onions or something. But really, you can just put the steamers in, because they're so spectacular on their own. And the steamer clam has so many subtleties. When you taste it, you know, you can taste the ocean. And to muck it up with too many ingredients, it ruins the whole point of it.
The other name for a steamer is the soft shell clam, right?
It is. And it is soft. The shell is very fragile, which is why steamers are one of the seafood that you really do have to come to the East Coast for. And they're starting to farm raise them on the West Coast because they don't travel well. You know, when I was a kid growing up in New Jersey, sometimes my dad, who was, you know, he was a wonderful guy, but sometimes he'd bring us to the bar on his way home on Saturday afternoons.
Yeah.
And the bars down at the shore used to give the steamers away for free. And now steamers are really expensive. Well, I used to say, Dad, could I get a bag of beer nuts? And he's like, no, eat the steamers. They're free. So.
Oh, for the good old days.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Now they're $140 a bushel.
Jasper, do you think that you're ever going to be drawn maybe to some of the foods from the land, like pork, beef, that kind of thing?
Well, I like to use pork in seafood dishes a lot. And I love to eat meat. I'm like everybody else. I eat meat once or twice or three times a week, and I love it.
But, that's pretty democratic.
You know, for a lifelong healthy diet, seafood's the key. And I am very concerned about the future, but I'm also optimistic because I believe that focusing on any one species in terms of the environment mm-hmm. is a mistake because the environment always adapts. What we need to do is focus on the overall health of the ocean because I really believe whatever can grow will grow. And I've watched the cod be really depleted. But at the same time, you know, cod eat lobsters and the lobster population has maintained really strongly. I've watched striped bass go from the verge of extinction to coming back in a very good way. And I believe in regulations, and I don't believe in all the doom and gloom, because I think if there is algae in the ocean and there's feed in the ocean and the water is not completely polluted, mm-hmm. something's going to grow. And I have never found anything in the ocean that I can't make taste good.
Jasper, thank you.
Thank you.
Chef Jasper White is author of the Summer Shack Cookbook, The Complete Guide to Shore Food. Now, Jasper has left us with three sauces for your summer kitchen. You've got the cold cucumber sauce, wasabi lime vinaigrette, and maple lemon glaze. Now, you can find them all on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, we want to point out that you can now download podcasts of our entire program for free. So there is no reason to miss even a single week. I mean, you can take us along on vacation. We travel very well. When food writers fact-check information about Italy, Nancy Harmon Jenkins is one of the sources they routinely go to. She's researched in Italy for 30 years, and she's relentless about getting the information right. Her new book is about what I think of as red sauce country, southern Italy, which embraces the regions of Sicily, Puglia, Basilicata, Calabria, and Campania. The book is called Cucina del Sole, a celebration of southern Italian cooking. Hey, Nancy, welcome.
Thank you. You know, I'd like to talk about tomatoes because they're so identified with southern Italy, but specifically the San Marzano tomato, because practically every food writer you can think of always says you've got to use San Marzanos.
Right, right. There's a real myth about them. And sometimes I think that myth is slightly misplaced because, well, there are a lot of San Marzanos in the world, but there is only one true genuino San Marzano, and that's the one that's grown under the slopes of Mount Vesuvius in what's called the Agro Sarnese, which is outside Naples, the south slopes of Vesuvius, mm-hmm. in a very dense, mineral-rich soil that just seems perfect for tomatoes. Probably, you know, when you go back to Mexico and you look for where tomatoes are growing there, you'd probably find that a lot of them were growing in volcanic soil, too.
But all right, I'm a little confused here. You look on the can, and the can says San Marzano tomatoes.
Yeah.
You're
yeah.
saying that not all San Marzano tomatoes are actually
well, they
from
are
that
San
region.
Marzano, but they're not the real ones. The real ones, I believe they have a DOP, Denominazione di Origine Protetta. In translated into English, that means a protected denomination of origin. And what it means is that if you think of wines are a very good example of this. Only the wine that comes from a specific region, made from specific grapes, pressed in a certain manner and aged in a certain manner, can have that name. And similarly, this is a movement throughout Europe to extend this designation to all kinds of food products, but particularly food products that have a lot of tradition behind them. And so you would have a DOP that means this is a protected denomination of origin. Only those tomatoes that come from the Agro Sarnese, that wonderful district close to Naples, under the slopes of Mount Vesuvius, only San Marzanos grown in that region can be given this DOP, San Marzano, from the Agro Sarnese. And that's what you want to look for. And there aren't a lot of them, and they're very, very expensive. but they are this very precious fruit. It's not really an heirloom tomato. You know, it really doesn't date back before the early 20th century mm-hmm. when it was developed in that region down there. It's a pear-shaped tomato, which means that it has more flesh than it does juice and seeds and so
right.
forth. It's the opposite of a beefsteak tomato. But it came from down there, and it kind of died out, the original one, because it had a very thin skin on it. And obviously, anything with a thin skin doesn't go very far to market. And so the breeders worked hard on developing a San Marzano with thicker skin, but it didn't have the great flavor that the original one had. Well, at a certain point, a couple of years ago, and I'm going to say this is in the last 10 years, mm-hmm. no longer ago than that, somebody discovered that at Cirio, which is probably the largest supplier of canned tomatoes in Italy, there was a seed bank. And in that seed bank, there were the seeds of these original, unmessed about with San Marzano tomatoes.
Uh-huh.
And so a very smart young grower named Sabato Abagnale, who lived there in that fabulous Agro Sarnese where he farmed, he started planting these things and he started getting people excited about them and they started growing them out. And then, interestingly enough, the slow food movement got involved in it. In fact, Carlo Petrini himself, who is the head of the slow food and always has been,
right.
took it upon himself to promote this tomato. And gradually, more and more people, it's not as though there were hordes of people growing them. I think there are probably no more than 6 growers right now. But they're so delicious that everybody wants them.
And they've always been tomatoes that have been canned, right?
Right. They have been because of that thin skin. I mean, you could use them, you know, if you're down there in the Agro Sarnese and you're making a tomato salad for dinner, you'd use the San Marzanos that you've got to hand.
Right.
And you'd be very happy with them. But because of the thin skin, they can very well. They don't lose their shape in the can. And at the same time, the skin is so thin that when you cook it into a sauce, the skin sort of dissolves out of it.
So they're actually canned with the skins on.
Yeah, yeah. Unlike you know, most of the canned tomatoes that you buy, I mean, even the very finest quality canned tomatoes usually have the skins removed, but not the San Marzano, not the true San Marzano.
Well, Nancy, thanks for straightening out the San Marzano puzzle.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure.
Nancy Harmon Jenkins is author of Cucina del Sole, a celebration of Southern Italian cooking. Now, she left us with a tomato recipe from Calabria that's excellent on the grill. It's simply called squash tomatoes. Find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Few groups test products like Consumer Reports magazine does. They accept no advertising and pride themselves on looking at every side of whatever issue they're examining. Now, recently they took on the hot dog. To find out how the test turned out, I have Nicole Saunders here. Now, she's Consumer Reports Associate Health and Family Editor. Nicole, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
So, how do you test hot dogs at Consumer Reports?
Well, Lynn, let me tell you, this was one of the most coveted story assignments, I think, possibly ever. you know, we cooked up 620 full-fat and lower-fat dogs from 23 leading brands. And that's everything from Oscar Mayer to Nathan's to Hebrew National to Ball Park. We used a concession-style grill, what you would sort of find at, you know, when you go to the ballpark game or
right.
even some vendors on the street. So we did it, you know, real deal.
So hot dogs get a really bad rap as being, you know, filled with things that you don't even want to know about and being really bad for you. Is that still true?
Well, according to the USDA, their set of standards that manufacturers have to follow, hot dogs are made up of beef, poultry, or pork, or maybe a mix of all those things, no more than 30% fat, some seasoning, some water, some sweeteners. However, one point to keep in mind is you don't want to make it a regular part of your diet, even if it's lower fat.
Let's talk about these dogs that are supposedly better for us. What did you discover about the low dogs, the low sodium, the low fat dogs?
What we found with the lower fat dogs, which was really sort of encouraging, was that they tasted nearly as good as the full fat dogs. We highlighted 3 in particular.
Which brands were they?
Hebrew National Kosher Reduced Fat Beef Franks.
Mm-hmm.
Boar's Head Light Skinless Beef Franks, and Oscar Mayer Light Beef Franks.
What about the low-sodium ones?
Well, The Franks that we tested had a sodium range of 300 to 760 milligrams per Frank. So this really is a food that's going to give you a hefty chunk of sodium.
The other area that I think people are very attuned to are the nitrate-free dogs. How did they turn out in your testing?
Well, just because a hot dog is labeled uncured doesn't mean it's free of nitrates and nitrites. Manufacturers get to use that label if none of those chemicals have been added, but they actually occur naturally in some spices, food, and water, so it's possible for them to still be in your Franks. And the three uncured Franks that we tested, they said they had no added nitrates and nitrites, but they actually did contain them because they occurred naturally. But all the hot dogs we tested had nitrates and nitrites that were well, well below the maximum level established by the USDA.
That's good to know.
Yeah, so just not to overly worry anyone out there.
Nicole, are hot dogs safe to eat uncooked?
No, Lynn, they're not. So here's the thing. Hot dogs are fully cooked when you buy them.
Uh-huh.
And that factory cooking is really important in killing bacteria such as Listeria. But you still need to do a really good job of heating them up since they can become contaminated before packaging, and the bacteria can even grow while refrigerated. So you'll want to heat them until they're steaming hot. Experts tell us you can use a food thermometer to make sure they reach about 165 degrees Fahrenheit. And Lynn, you'll also want to make sure that you store them properly. So refrigerate them as soon as you get them home. Don't leave them out of the cooler or off the grill for more than 2 hours. Less if the temperature is hot. Don't leave them out for more than 1 hour if it's above 90 degrees.
Okay. So out of all of these tastings, what were the top hot dogs? And did you find sort of the paragon of the hot dog?
Well, none of the hot dogs rated excellent. But we did find some that were very good. That included Hebrew National Kosher Beef Franks, Nathan's Famous Skinless Beef Franks, and Boar's Head Skinless Beef Franks. Those were at the head of the pack.
And they're all probably in the supermarket tempting us. Hey, Nicole, thank you so much for this.
Thank you, Lynn.
Nicole Saunders is Consumer Reports Associate Health and Family Editor. The magazine's article on hot dogs appeared in July 2007. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge, and of course, I couldn't let the hot dog thing go. This one is a multiple choice. Which three of the following artists or groups sang a song that either mentioned hot dogs or had hot dog in the title? Now, the choices are Elvis Presley, The Rolling Stones, Joni Mitchell, Led Zeppelin, or Bob Dylan. And we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget. It's Target, now available in food. At SuperTarget, you can find the foods and ingredients for your favorite recipes, plus the things you need to serve it up, all in one stop. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I have got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was a multiple choice, and it comes from the National Hot Dog and Sausage Council site. Here it is. Which three of the following artists or groups sang a song that either mentioned hot dogs or had hot dog in the title? Now, the choices are Elvis Presley, The Rolling Stones, Joni Mitchell, Led Zeppelin, or Bob Dylan. Well, if you came up with Elvis, Led Zeppelin, and Bob Dylan, you got it right. Elvis did the song Hot Dog from the album Loving You. Led Zeppelin did one on In Through the Outdoor, and Bob Dylan mentioned hot dogs in his Talkin' World War III Blues. Could we have a little of that Zeppelin, please? Okay. Pick up that phone and call. The number is 800-537-5252. We have got Charlie calling from, I think I'm pronouncing it correctly, Bothell, Washington. Is that the correct pronunciation, Charlie?
Yes, that is.
I'll be darned, I actually got it right. What do you want to talk about?
Last spring, my wife and I were vacationing in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
While in Rome, we went into a small panini shop off a piazza that sold vegetables and flowers.
Right.
I decided on a pork panini, and the pork panini was available with or without skin. The pork was spiced and garlic flavored, and the pork skin was crunchy and delicious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm actually looking to recreate this, but I could never get the skin crunchy.
Yeah, yeah. I'll tell you what you were eating. It is Central Italy's, and much of Italy's now, favorite fair food, outdoor street market food. It's been around for I don't know how long. Everybody makes it a little differently, but essentially it's called porchetta. And it is usually the entire loin of the pig or an entire young pig. That is, if it's boned, and usually it is, what you do is you actually make deep cuts in the loin, or you make a long spiral cut, and you flavor it with garlic, olive oil, often with things like fresh fennel or fennel seeds, rosemary, oregano, a lot of black pepper. And you insert that actually into the meat. And you rub the exterior with olive oil and coarse salt, and you slow roast it. Now, if you get a young pig, you get a very fine, thin skin that is very, it's like crackly. Is that what you had? Is that what you're remembering?
Yes, it was crackly. It was wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, that's why I was groaning when you were describing it. I mean, there is really nothing quite like that skin and this delicious pork. And what happens is you can do this ahead, and then it's chilled. Some people keep it at room temperature, and it's thin sliced for sandwiches. And you can make it by just doing, for instance, your pork shoulder. Don't use the loin, because the loin in America is so dry with today's pork, unless you're getting something like Berkshire pork or Duroc. It's so dry, it's so lean, that it's an insult. What you want to do is a shoulder of pork, boned, and you make lots of slits in it and put in these seasonings. You can leave that overnight in the fridge so they'll permeate a little bit. And then what you can do is ask the butcher for pork skin. It's still going to be chewy because it comes from a more mature pig. But you can, what I would do is roast the pork skin separately, but I would do a slow roast on that. Don't braise it, roast it. 325, 300 maybe, and baste it with a bit of white wine and its own juices. Obviously, you've rubbed the skin with salt and pepper and olive oil.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, I mean, how could you not, right? Mm. But if you can get a very young pig, where do you live again? You're in Washington State.
We're actually just out of Seattle.
Seattle is heaven in terms of food availability. Your whole area is. I mean, a very young pig would give you exactly what you want. And think of the party you could have.
Indeed.
Yeah, I mean, all your friends will want to come. The only thing is you have to tell them that eating pork skin is extremely bad for them. And in fact, people have been known to get deathly ill from pork skin, so that you're saving them from that. And then you can... You can hide it.
Then I get it all for myself.
You got it all for yourself. But that's what the recipe or the dish is called porchetta. And that's the basic idea behind it. And I hope that helps.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You are welcome. You're in for a great treat.
Okay.
Call us, 800-537-5252. There is a market stall somewhere in central Italy in a little town, I can't remember the name of it, where they had the porchetta warm and they had the pan juices. And when you asked for the sandwich, they took the equivalent of a big round hard roll and they dipped just the cut side into the warm pan juices, then piled on the sliced meat and the thin sliced crackling skin. And if you want to know what religion is, this is religion in food. Call us, 800-537-5252. We have got John calling from St. Louis. Hey, John, what do you want to talk about?
Hi. Well, you know, I'm trying to, first of all, I have seven children at home, so there's nine of us.
This is like running a restaurant every day, right?
Oh, it really is. And I'm trying to have us eat healthier. And of course, you know, I go into my market, and there's all of this fruit, and, you know, anything more than a kiwi is a little exotic to me. And I was wondering if you could give me a little advice on the different types of fruit.
Oh, boy. Okay. You're talking now tropical fruit.
Yes, tropical fruit. You know, star fruit and
star
fruit that's got a French name. I mean, just all sorts of stuff.
Well, this is what I know, and I know I'm not a complete expert on this, but I have to tell you what helped a lot was spending a little time in Hawaii. Where, you know, it was literally you picked it off the tree. It was almost sinful. Star fruit is very citrus-like. It has a nice tart snap to it. And you slice it crossways in that star pattern, throw it in a salad, decorate a plate with it, put it in a fruit salad. It's really delicious. And you know what I love with it is cream cheese. And yeah, little snippets of cream cheese, and you put the star fruit in your mouth and you have a little bite of that cream cheese. Another thing, the great peach of the tropics, one of the greatest fruits you will ever put in your mouth is the mango. Uh-huh. And when you buy a mango, you want to sniff it, first of all. It should smell sweet. The other thing is it should have a little give to it. And the way a mango, the anatomy of a mango is a little tricky. Because it's this rather good-sized, I'd say about 6-7 inches high and maybe 4 inches wide, rounded. But the pit is this big, flat pit in the very center of the fruit. So when you cut into a mango, you essentially stand it on end and take your knife, drive it down through the center, and when you hit something solid, edge the knife around it all the way down to the cutting board.
Like opening up an avocado.
Exactly. And then do the same thing on the other side so that you release the pit. And then now you have these sort of two concave halves of the mango. And one of the great ways to eat it, and the kids should love this because it's going to be like eating watermelon. What you do is you make a crosshatch. You cut down to the skin one way and then another, right? So now you've got this crosshatch cut on each half. Uh-huh. And then you turn them inside out. So it's like this dome, and it sticks up like a porcupine.
Oh, neat.
Yeah, and some people eat it with a spoon, but the way I'd sell this to the kids is you just put your face in it and start eating. And it's messy, and it's sweet, and it is so good. A little lime juice on it. You can make smoothies with this that will make you want to weep. They're so good. But mango, I could live on mango. I mean, well, if you love peaches, you're going to love mangoes.
Sure.
Now, the papaya, there are many, many different kinds of papaya. And that what that always looks like to me, it's either looks like a big torpedo that's kind of greenish yellow, or it looks a bit like a pear that was on steroids. And what's beautiful about a papaya, I mean, sometimes the flesh is a rosy color, and sometimes the flesh is this incredible orangey yellow. And it has these shiny bead-like black seeds in the center. It's this fruit that when you cut it in half, it's begging to be photographed. And it tastes like a combination of pineapple and sweet ripe pear, to me anyway. And again, it's one of those things with a little lime juice, a little black pepper. By the way, all of these things love chili. Now, again, I'm not sure how the kids would take to that, but a little bit of chili on these things just seems to up the sweetness on it.
All right. That's worth a try.
Yeah, and papaya pureed. And making homemade ice cream with papaya or mango. Just substitute, you know, find a strawberry ice cream recipe, but substitute papaya or mango or even star fruit. You'll be in heaven. So papaya, eat it straight. Put some citrus on it. Put some chili on it. A lot of people love the combination of papaya and banana. Just slices of each. Now, when the papaya is firm and green, you thin slice it and you mix it with a sweet sour sauce from the Southeast Asia and chili and have a papaya salad. You do it in shreds like pasta.
Uh-huh.
That's killer. And then there's, guava. And guava's small. And as I remember, it's kind of brown colored and it has a real citrusy taste. And then there's passion fruit that is also kind of small and dark. And when it's ripe, it almost feels like it's going to go bad because it's so soft in spots.
Uh-huh.
But it has the taste of a sunset in Hawaii. It tastes like it's tartness, has a piece of tartness to it. Tastes like super ripe grapes that have been combined with honeydew melon. If you can imagine that combination.
I can, and I'm suddenly becoming very hungry.
I think you're in for a lot of fun.
Well, thank you so much.
You are welcome. You take care, John.
You too.
Bye. Bye-bye. Call us, 800-537-5252. Let's see, who's up next?
We have Susan calling from St. Paul. Susan, what do you want to talk about?
Lynn, I have a pumpkin plant growing in my backyard.
Right.
And I have lots of blossoms. I'm wondering if I can prepare them like I would squash blossoms. And if so, how would I prepare squash blossoms?
Well, I have to tell you, we tried a bunch of recipe tests with other, you know, typically squash blossoms or zucchini blossoms. And sometimes pumpkin blossoms and gourd blossoms and other squash blossoms tend to be a little strong. But the reality is, it is always worth a shot. So here's the thing. When the flowers have opened, okay, mm-hmm. what you do, and usually it's the male flowers. The female flowers are the ones that actually are going to be where the actual pumpkin comes from.
Okay.
So those you don't, I mean, those you could use, but those don't work quite the same way. You want about an inch or two of stem.
Okay.
You take the flowers, and one of the things you do is you remove the pistil in the center.
Oh, okay.
Okay, I think it's called the pistil. And I don't wash it as much as I wipe it out, because if they're really fragile and you try to wash them, mm-hmm. you know, you lose it.
Oh, sure.
So I just kind of make sure there's nothing inside that's moving. And obviously, you haven't sprayed anything on the stuff.
No, no.
And then what you do is you want about a half inch of oil in a large skillet. And you take a little flour and you'd have beaten egg in one shallow bowl and some flour that you've seasoned with salt and pepper in the other bowl. And you dip in egg and then you roll in flour. And you put them in the shallow oil that's hot. And you, once it's crisp on one side, you flip them over. And you crisp them on the other. And then you put them on some paper towels to drain. You sprinkle them with salt. And you eat them right away.
Oh, what do they taste like?
They taste slightly sweet, slightly herbal, and deliciously crunchy. Whereas some blossoms can get a little bitter or strong. You're going to know right away. Start out with one or two.
Sure.
Just taste first.
Okay.
And if it turns out they're not great, why don't you kind of trade pumpkins for zucchini blossoms? Because you've got to know there's going to be a neighbor who's overwhelmed.
All right.
So you're home free.
Thanks.
You take care.
You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Zucchini blossoms. You know, this is the only reason you plant zucchini. Get those blossoms. Get those flowers. Call us. 800-537-5252. Okay, I've got news that should be just the excuse a lot of us have been waiting for. A new pizza discovery. Recently at a national meeting of the American Chemical Society, a study of pizzas was presented. Now, it showed that some pizzas have higher antioxidants. Lucy Yu is Associate Professor of Food Chemistry at the University of Maryland. Now, she led this study. Professor Yu, welcome.
Hi.
So could you explain what you were looking for and how was the study done?
Our purpose was to find out a way through food preparation to make sure the final food product contains a higher level of antioxidants.
And you were looking at the crust of the pizza, am I correct?
Yes. We only look at the crust of pizza.
So how did you do the test?
Basically, we tested different whole wheat flours with different slow fermentation conditions, different baking conditions. Then we examined what kind of condition will give us higher antioxidant contents in the finished pizza crust.
So how did it work out then?
Well, the results showed that if we increase the baking temperature, mm-hmm. but not burning the pizza crust,
right.
so bake it for a longer time, let the dough ferment for a little bit longer, we may be able to increase the antioxidant contents.
What kind of percentages are we talking about? What kind of increase in antioxidants?
Longer fermentation time may increase by as much as 100% of antioxidants in the finished product.
That's pretty significant. And with the longer baking and higher temperature, were there similar large percentages of increase in antioxidants?
Yes, very significant.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
60% during longer baking time and up to 82% with higher baking temperature.
Hmm. Professor Yu, thank you for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Lucy Yu is Associate Professor of Food Chemistry at the University of Maryland. She led the pizza study, which was presented at the National Meeting of the American Chemical Society in March 2007. Now, I've been thinking that if slow fermentation and long high temperature baking makes for more antioxidants in whole wheat pizza crust, than a lot of the artisan breads that are made with a little yeast and long rising times could have more antioxidants too. And you don't have any fat from the cheese either, right? Well, anyway, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. Have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this thought from Sam Keen. He said, deep summer is when laziness finds respectability. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our free weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and get yourself registered for our seasonal newsletter, The Griller's Chronicle, running through the summer grill season. And just in case you miss us one week, you can find free podcasts of our entire program at splendidtable.org. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell, with intern help from Andrew Schumacher. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Please join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.